Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing Charles Moore, former editor of The Spectator, The Daily Telegraph, and The Sunday Telegraph, and the authorised biographer of Margaret Thatcher. And we're talking because now is the 50th anniversary of her becoming Tory leader on 11th of February 1975. And in your terrific book, it was by no means a foregone conclusion. Heath lost the October 74 election. Everyone wanted to get rid of him, is that right, within the Tory party?
Well, not everyone, but there was a strong feeling that he had to go, but no clear vision of who should replace him.
Margaret Thatcher had no plans to stand it. She backed Keith Joseph.
Yes. It wasn't quite true that she had no plans, or at least she certainly did have ambitions, but Keith Joseph had been her great, and continued to be her great mentor. And she wanted, she obviously would defer to him as a much more senior person. But she records in her memoirs that Keith surprised her by saying, I don't want to do this. But actually, that she telescopes events when she says that. It was already pretty clear to her before he said that directly that he was not going to stand, and she had therefore made preparations. She was certainly totally loyal to him. She didn't try and push him away from standing, but his own personal qualities meant that he was unsuitable to stand. He's sort of Hamletic, charming Hamletic figure who overthought everything and lacked ruthless ambition. She sort of understood that and was therefore ready at the point at which he told her that he wasn't going to stand, and she'd already made some preliminary plans. They were a very primitive kind, and then she said she'd do it. And in those days, the arrangements were quite slow. So she said, made it public in November that she would do it, but she wasn't elected till, as you said, February. So there was quite a long hiatus, not exactly hiatus, but a lot of Tory MPs had to decide what are they going to do about this over quite a long period, and she didn't have by any means the necessary backing when she announced her candidacy. And the key thing was that Airey Neave, leading backbencher, decided, but only really after Christmas, that he would back her. And once he had decided that, then it got into full gear, the campaign, and she won over the next 6 weeks. But if I think he specifically had not, Airey had not decided, hard to see how she could have worked her way through. As a woman in that world, it was extremely difficult for her to campaign for herself. For example, and remember that the only electorate at that time was MPs. So, for example, in her whole career in Parliament, she never went into the smoking room alone, because she's a woman and you don't go alone into a sort of male bar. And she absolutely couldn't fraternise in the way that her male MP would be able to do. And anyway, she's not a fraternising type of person. So you had to have this sort of Knights of the Shires type MPs coming in behind her, and she could not achieve that directly. She had to achieve it by help from someone like Airey Neave, and that's what happened.
And you just chaired a very enjoyable event about the 50th anniversary, and there was Alison Wakeham, who was Margaret Thatcher's secretary, who was very sympathetic, and it was an incredibly small operation. Basically, yes. The two of them, and they didn't even have a phone, is that right?
Well, of course, there were no mobiles then, and yes, it was basically, in terms of who did Mrs. Thatcher employ at the time, the answer was Alison. That's it. And even at the time, it was considered rather a small setup, and now it would seem quite ludicrous as people have spads and advisors and PR people. And of course, she had supporters, but even that was quite thin on the ground in Parliament. And until Airey Neave came in, they were sort of quite oddballs. But it was understood, rightly, that the best way for Mrs. Thatcher to campaign was not to go around herself glad-handing MPs, but to get on with her duties, which were shadow Treasury spokesman. Sounds very dull, because she wasn't even shadow Chancellor, she was number two, because it was Heath and he didn't like her. But the thing was, in those days, Parliament was doing much more proper scrutiny of legislation, and by good chance for Mrs. Thatcher, the finance bill was in committee of the whole House, and this meant that night after night, she had to argue with the government about the details of the finance bill, and she was brilliant at it. And because, again, the opposition, the way the House of Commons worked in those days gave much more power to opposition. I say night after night deliberately, not day after day, because she was sometimes up till 2 a.m. debating very complicated issues of taxation in front of the colleagues who were her constituency, as it were, for election. And they were very, very impressed. I mean, I think she made 8 speeches on the finance bill in those key weeks. And you know, they had to be there because of the whip and so on and all through the night. And she was absolutely on top of it and very good at that combination of knowledge and also attack. So she knew how to, the very clever, not very nice Chancellor Dennis Healey, she could sort of get him on the run, which was a real achievement. And so you could, unfortunately, this doesn't really happen now. So candidates to be a leader are not properly tested in the House of Commons as they were in those days, and she really was. And it happened to be the right time, and she passed the test.
And she was also being destabilised by dirty tricks from Ted Heath's side. I think they weaponised an article about hoarding, is that right?
That's right. It's all to do with the very long lead times of magazines in those days. So Mrs. Thatcher had given an interview to a magazine called Pre-Retirement Choice, which she had given before she was a candidate, but which appeared after she had become a candidate. And the reason she was talking to it was that Dennis was about to retire, her husband. And so there was a sort of peg to talk about these issues. And in talking about all this, she said that because of inflation, she would quite often, if she saw goods in the shop which were a good price, buy them, even if she didn't need them immediately, because they were going to go up in price. This came out. Heath's people somehow got hold of this obscure magazine and sort of splashed it through the allies in the newspapers. And the accusation against Mrs. Thatcher was she's a hoarder, which had great resonance at the time because of this was in the Second World War, that this was wrong. And remember, the Second World War was much nearer to that time than we are to that time, much. This was used against her. And Erin Eve and others said, oh, this is terrible, you've got to get out of this, you run away from this issue. But she said, no, I'm not a hoarder, and I'm going to explain what I'm doing. And people will understand this because I'm a housewife, and the women know what it's like and have to deal with the problem of living in an age of inflation, because they go out and they manage the household budgets and they go and do the shopping. And so she invited all the press into her very small, almost galley kitchen, and opened the door of her larder, but not really a larder, but a big cupboard, and said, look, these are the crimes I've allegedly committed. Here are sort of tin peaches, sort of Heinz London Grill or something. Sort of 25 cans, something like that. I mean, totally yes. Reasonable. And so brilliantly and visually, she turned round the attack into a benefit. And that's what she was very good at doing with attack. And, of course, the most classic one of that was the very phrase, the Iron Lady, which was coined by the Russians, by the Soviets, Red Army newspaper, saying that she was an Iron Lady. And they meant it as a sexist joke, because they said Germany had an Iron Chancellor, Britain's got an Iron Lady, ha, 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 because you can't be iron if you're a lady, sort of thing. And she immediately grabbed this and said, I'm not ashamed, I'm proud to be called an Iron Lady if it means that I'm defending the Western world against Soviet communism. And she made a famous speech and said she especially wore a red dress for it so that she could make jokes about being red and not being red. And this was a very transformative skill of hers. And she was, despite being sort of old-fashioned person in many ways, she was a very, very good campaigner in what was then a modern sense. And so the hoarding thing came right back against Ted Heath. And solidified the idea that she was A, brave, and B, different. And I think it was the both of those things, but particularly with that constituency, the bravery which impressed all these backbenchers, who were pretty, many of whom had fought in the war, who were pretty fed up with Heath. And Mrs. Thatcher was not their natural cup of tea because, you know, she was a woman, she wasn't upper class or even upper middle class, etc. But they thought, you know, she's a brave girl, we're fed up with Ted, let's give her a go. It was very unideological. And in addition to that, she did have ideological support because she had free marketeers who were absolutely fed up with the dirigiste policies of the Heath government, particularly prices and incomes policy to control inflation. So that was a powerful combination on which she very successfully played.
But and she says things like that at this time, the party isn't ready for a woman. She says, I have no chance. And Dennis says she won't win. Do you think she actually thought she wouldn't win, or she was quite confident?
I wouldn't say she was confident, but I think she had decided that it was worth it, that she had a chance and that she really had something to say. And I think to understand Margaret Thatcher throughout, you have to understand this mixture of principle and ambition, or principle and ruthlessness, a principle and knowing when to pick the moment. And she'd been pretty ideologically consistent, always on the right of the party, but basically conformist until 1974. She'd risen successfully up the ladder. She'd got into the cabinet in a not very senior position and didn't do particularly well as education secretary. But, you know, you could see she was formidable. And I think what changed her view was the defeat in February 74, when she realised that it wasn't inevitable that the Conservatives get everything right. You know, she's a party loyalist, and she thought, we're right, socialists are wrong. And she realised, we've got it wrong. And the country, which I love, and she was very patriotic, is going the wrong way. So something's got to be done. And then it quite quickly turns into her mind in, and I can do it, and I must try. And
In 74.
And, of course, that didn't really come to fruition until a second defeat for the party in the same year, in October. But she was already thinking about it between February and October. And then it becomes sort of crystal clear that something must be done. And then Keith Joseph pulls out and she's ready. And so I think she had actually quite appropriate mixture of determination and, you could say, modesty. She did not think, I'm owed this, I'm the best. She thought, I must try to do this.
And it helped that Heath was a terrible campaigner, wasn't he? You describe him being encouraged to go into the smoking room, and he just sat there and had a drink on his own.
Yes. No, he and this is very difficult for all prime ministers when they're under, and she found it when she was thrown out, before she was thrown out, very difficult for a prime minister to campaign for themselves within the House of Commons, because they necessarily have a certain remoteness from these things, and they have a lot of achievements, and probably if they're being challenged so severely, it's probably too late, but of course they can't think that, so they don't quite actually know what to do. But Heath was always very, very bad at this anyway, and it was just absolutely part of his character. So one occasion, this is not when he was campaigning, but it just illustrates the point, a friend of mine told me this, and she was one of the few women who had anything much to do with Heath and helping him. And she saw him at a dinner. And he was, as is customary at dinners, there was a woman on each side of him. And so she wrote him a note, which she gave to the butler, which said, talk to the women, because he was sitting there in total silence. And he got the note and he wrote on it, I have. and now he, you know, he changed two sentences, but that was more than enough in his view. And he was just sitting there staring into space. And he was just the most impossible person in that way.
And very unpleasant. You describe Margaret Thatcher going in to politely tell him she's going to stand. And What does he say?
I think he said, sorry, I'm doing this from memory. I think he said, you'll lose.
Yes, that's what I've got.
And then he left the room in his house. So she then had to stay there for about 20 minutes because it would look as if... that was a later occasion. He said, you lose, and that's it. There was no more conversation. Pretty well kicked her out. And so he was asking for trouble.
I do remember when I was working for the Telegraph and he died in 2005, and there was the great Bill Deeds, who'd known him well, who was extremely nice about everyone, who said, will you write a tribute to him. He said, I don't think I can think of anything nice to say.
Well, Bill did tell me, I mean, sorry, stop me if these anecdotes are superfluous, but yeah. I remember Bill, when I was a young man and he was my editor, he described a dinner at his home in Aldington, which was given by Lord Aldington, his big friend. So it was the Aldingtons, the Deedses, and Ted Heath. And it had just taken place at this time, so this would be about 1981 or something. And as Bill described it, it went as follows, which was, the conversation was a bit sticky, and my wife, whose thoughts seldom rise above the animal kingdom, turned to Ted and she said, isn't it dreadful the way they've treated Enoch? And then there was silence for some 2 hours.
And Margaret Thatcher was helped to a great extent, is that right, at this time by the advice of Gordon Rees, is that correct?
Yes, Gordon Rees had had connections with the Conservatives but was by profession a PR. And he could see the angel in the marble of Margaret Thatcher as a performer. So she was pretty wooden as a public performer, but he could see how that could change. And had helped her a bit before in earlier times. And he also was the one who met Laurence Olivier on the train. And this was a bit later, and persuaded Olivier to arrange for her to get voice coaching. So essentially what he saw was that she had a very strong and arresting personality and a good way of saying things, but it was all muddled up with sort of being too starchy and unnatural and, if you like, sort of reserved, not exactly the right word, but that this could be changed. And that she was a potentially brilliant communicator. And so he got to work on all this. And she was humble about this in what I think was a professional way. So she wasn't going to sort of temper her message in an untruthful way, but she was prepared to jettison anything which got in the way of the communication of the message. So she would change her hair, her teeth, her voice.
The voice came down.
Yes.
How did the hair and the teeth change?
Well, the hair sort of got more waved up and less fussy, and the voice went down, and the teeth were... she had bad teeth, so that she had, somewhere or other, better ones. and similarly, the clothes, so they had to simplify for television. You can't have all this sort of fussy bows and complicated stripes and things like that in television, and not too much jewellery. And she tended to have rather too much jewellery, which I think personally came from being actually a rather sort of Jewish aesthetic, which was to do with being the MP for Finchley, where a lot of Jewish ladies would dress up in a way that Gentiles would think was too smart, really. And Jewish ladies being more careful about self-presentation than the average Gentile, English Gentile. And she was a bit like that. So you needed to sort of tone all that down, simplify it, have block colours, and it worked. And then there were all these tricks to make her feel better about broadcasting, so which Tim Bell also helped with. So, for example, he liked to get lots of flowers into the room when she was broadcasting, not necessarily visible, sometimes visible to the camera, but sometimes just visible to her. And he would,
because she liked flowers so much, or just can't hit that.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And he, Bell, and he, Rees, would sometimes be sitting at sort of eye level with her, so that off, sort of, that, so as it were, she was talking to them. Though, of course, the public couldn't see that. So it was all very carefully worked out. And the other thing that Rees understood about campaigning, which was television, which of course is everybody understands now, but it was sort of new then, is don't imagine that you should be communicating a vast number of policy points. It's, as he said, a medium of impressions, not of facts. So create the right impression. Have the right words which purify the message, and don't get tangled up with a whole lot of things that are too complicated. And she's very good at that, because she could do the complicated stuff because she understood the detail, but she's a natural preacher. So she, and that came from her sort of Wesleyan tradition, so that she could expound points with great clarity and sort of moral fervour. And also take advantage of your supposed disadvantage, which is you're a woman in a man's world, make it interesting, which it is. It was very unusual and still is to some extent unusual. And that's the impact of that is fantastic. So, and she understood that. So the handbag, which is almost a sort of comic accessory in a man's world, becomes the symbol of power, and it therefore becomes a verb, to handbag. And when she retired, George Shultz, the US Secretary of State, gave a nice dinner for her in Washington where he joked about the verb to handbag, and he gave her a handbag with out of which he pulled various quotations of hers and so on. Brilliant piece of understanding of how she... the sort of magician's trick of the handbag.
And it appears our friend Nick Garland, the cartoonist for The Telegraph for many years, quite a lot of the cartoons are of her literally handbag,
yes,
people with her handbag.
Yes, absolutely. So it becomes the orb and sceptre of her rule.
And I was going to quote from my father, Ferdinand Mount, who's the head of her policy unit, about her character. And he said, while admiring her, he said she had no small talk at all. She actually had to have jokes explained to her sometimes, and she was indifferent to paradox, ambiguity, understatement, and saying the opposite of what you mean, which are things that most British people do the whole time. Would you agree with that, that she was a very unusual person?
Yes, though perhaps not so unusual in lower middle class Britain, but certainly unusual in sort of Oxbridge, though she did go to Oxford, in sort of Oxbridge circles where irony, ambiguity, etc. are treasured.
Yes.
Where I think Ferdy's right, but where I think this has led, not through his fault, to misrepresentation in lots of dramas and films, is that people think that because she's serious that she's somehow boring and takes the atmosphere out of the room. Quite the contrary, because she's very actressy and very vigorous, and in that sense, fun. So whenever Mrs. Thatcher came into the room, everybody's, and my witness, almost started to laugh and get excited, and sort of she's buzzing around the room, and she knows that she's acting her own part. So she would sort of fussily clear the table of the cups and saucers, and she'd make much of the men, very good at flattering men, and she would say one of her compliments, actually, which, of course, if you said it to a man, said it to a woman, would be an insult, but a compliment to her. She'd say, oh, you look so tired, you've been working so hard, let me, etc. And it was all sort of motherly and funny, and she would camp up her own performance.
That's so, the We Are a Grandmother.
Yeah,
and the
well, that actually, I think, was a different thing, but yes, in general. She would camp, so she would make a great gesture of, almost like a pantomime dame, of sort of, you know, ooh, you were dreadful sort of thing. And while it's true that she didn't make jokes, she didn't understand jokes, which I think are essentially a male phenomenon. There's jokes, like there was an Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman. She could be very witty. She could be very quick. And to the point. And a famous example is... She had to speak at a dinner or something. I think it was the 25th anniversary of the Institute of Economic Affairs, and she got very fed up because all these speeches came before her, and she was very bored. And so when she stood up, she said, "I've just listened to 6 speeches by men, and all I want to say is that the cocks may crow, but the hen lays the eggs." And that's witty.
Yes. Yeah.
And to the point.
Yeah.
And again, reinforces what happens when a woman takes charge in a man's world. So it's very effective, and of course it makes people laugh. So it's not true, when you see it in The Crown or something, she always seems as they correctly portray her seriousness, but they do not correctly portray the sort of animation of the whole thing.
And did she talk to you at length when you were interviewing her at length for your trilogy? About how extraordinarily difficult it was as a woman, but also against the snobbery that was aimed at her.
Yes, I think she was more concerned by the problem about being patronised as a woman than being patronised as the grocer's daughter, though both did happen. She was not... Sometimes she's regarded as a class war figure who's hostile to the upper classes. In my experience, that's not the case. She had a romantic idea about the upper classes, because they were part of the sort of tapestry of British history. And she had no objection to that at all, and indeed rather liked sort of connections with it, like Belton House, where she was brought up in at the edge of Grantham, had connections with that. But she could tell immediately when she was being patronised. So her first two prime ministers, Conservative prime ministers, under whom she served, were Macmillan and Douglas Hume, both upper class, basically. And Macmillan patronised her, and she didn't like him at all. And Hume was delightful to her and kind and interested, and she loved him. And she understood. She got it sort of within 30 seconds about which man was on which side in all of this. And she was not at all above flattering the one she liked. So that cemented the relationship. And I don't think that the... I think the Grocer's Daughter thing was... she used as a source of strength, because it meant she understood things that other people in politics didn't understand. And also remember that though she loved, was very proud of her provincial background, like most people with a provincial background who are very ambitious, she longed to get away from it. So she didn't particularly want to... the fact she learnt everything from Grantham didn't mean she wanted to be in Grantham. She wanted to be in the great world. And she only really exploited the Grantham bit once she was trying to be leader. And then she could see how it became what people now call a backstory, which... but her marriage to Dennis put her into a different class, which is certainly not upper class, but was sort of home counties Tory. And that's what she liked at that time. And then the roots became very important. Perhaps to some extent she wanted to get away from the roots, and then it became very important from 1974 onwards.
And you quote her as saying, "All my ideas about Britain were formed before I was 17 or 18. Do you think that's true, or that's part of...
I think that is more or less true. And another thing she would say, which again was to do with her interest in her Methodist background and her interest in the Bible and so on, is there are no new messages, really, but the thing to do is to find the best way of re-presenting them. So she didn't claim to be an original thinker, but she wanted to be an arresting politician and leader, and draw on ancient truths in modern clothes. And that's the sense in which she's radical and not radical. Very, very traditionalist in a way, but also absolutely determined to get all the sort of fusty stuff out of the way, so you understand why this matters now and why it matters for the future.
And we're coming up, as well as being the 50th anniversary of her becoming Tory leader, this 18th of October will be her centenary.
Sorry, isn't it the 13th of October?
Oh, sorry, forgive me. Yeah. Is it right to say, if you're going to try and work out the formation of her character, the cliché is that it's all to do with the tremendous closeness to her father, Alderman Alfred Roberts? Famously, she didn't include her mother in her Who's Who entry. Is that correct?
Yes, so I notice I've checked this. Actually, lots of people don't include their mother in Who's Who entries, so it doesn't automatically follow. It is correct, I think, in terms of her sort of mental formation. However, her mother was important. Her mother was not a clever woman, I think, and certainly not a sort of well-read woman and or a travelled person or anything like that. But her mother had a strong character of quite a disapproving kind, and very much the home builder that Mrs. Thatcher sort of admired but was not satisfied with that world. So she admired the fact her mother was a sempstress, and the business of making clothes without spending much money on them and remaking clothes, it was something that really interested her and was very much part of her character and part of how she kept her own house and wardrobe. And so those sort of virtues she admired, but I think she never had a rapport with her mother and wanted to get away from that. And the father, with whom her relationship was not untroubled, actually, but you know, he left school at 14, I think, but he would undoubtedly have gone to a good university in modern times, and because of the Methodism and his natural character, he was well read, well educated, self educated, often go to the library to read, public speaker because he was a local politician of non party kind in Grantham, and because he was a Methodist, I think they call it lay preacher, I think is the right term. And so she would often hear his sermons, and in fact, ad nauseam, she would hear his sermons. And so all of that was there, and it also opened a bigger world for her, because he would bring back visiting Methodist preachers to their parlour after some of whom came from India and some of whom were Indian, I mean, in colour, which is very unusual at the time. So she saw this sort of great world refracted through the seriousness of Methodism and the propriety of Rotary Club. And she was interested in all that. And her first ambition was to be an Indian civil servant, a civil servant in the Imperial Service of India.
Extraordinary. And by coincidence, only 6 months later, the late Queen Elizabeth II was born. It was exaggerated, the idea that they didn't get on. In fact, your book, you say they did get on rather well. Is that right?
I think that they found it difficult, particularly at first. Both of them found it difficult because neither of them had experience of working with a woman. And didn't particularly enjoy working with women, actually. And Mrs. Thatcher was difficult for the Queen because I think the Queen, like in these audiences, where important to remember that nobody else is present, no official at all, prime ministerial audiences of the Queen. The Queen would like it to be quite informal. But Mrs. Thatcher had difficulty with the Queen because she was very deferential to the role. It's sometimes portrayed in films and things that she's telling the Queen what to do. It's absolute rubbish. The opposite problem would be sort of too much curtsying too
deep. Very deep curtsying, yes,
dressing absolutely up to the nines and slightly giving a sort of recital of what... So she would sort of say what the parliamentary business was this week and that sort of thing. Well, first of all, we've got the privatisation of water bill or whatever. Rather than engaging in more relaxed discussion, and therefore they were somewhat unproductive. And there were one or two disagreements, of which the most important was one about South African sanctions. And what concerned the Queen, where I was not there, was not the issue of sanctions, but it was her role as head of the Commonwealth. So all the rest of the Commonwealth wanted sanctions against South Africa. Mrs. Thatcher didn't, and the Queen was conflicted because she's the Prime Minister of Great Britain, but she's the head of the Commonwealth. And what she sought was a unity, somehow avoiding a Commonwealth clash. And unfortunately, some of her thoughts leaked and were greatly magnified by her press secretary, who had to resign as a result. And Mrs. Thatcher was hurt by that. She felt that this was sort of improper and difficult. And the Queen actually, very unusually, when the story was about to come out in the Sunday Times, rang Mrs. Thatcher at Chequers and said, "I'm sorry, I gather this is happening, and it's not what I wanted at all." And she basically apologised to Mrs. Thatcher. However, the relationship was proper and respectful, and I think became more than that, really, with the resignation onwards, because on her resignation, the Queen offered her the Order of Merit on the spot, which she didn't have to do, and she was very touched by that. And then she came to Mrs. Thatcher's 70th birthday party and 80th birthday party, and above all, unusual, by the way, for a retired Prime Minister that should happen, and then, even more unusual, came to her funeral. And of all her incredibly large number of Prime Ministers, the only Prime Ministers to whose funeral she went were Winston Churchill's and Margaret Thatcher's. So that was quite definitely a mark of real respect. And Robert Fellowes, her wonderful Queen's wonderful private secretary, now sadly deceased, told me that after the funeral he and the Queen discussed it, and he said the one thing I worried was whether I wondered, said Robert, is whether Mrs. Thatcher should have had a gun carriage. She wasn't a military leader. Of course, she had won the Falklands War, but he's correct, she wasn't exactly a military leader. And he said, the Queen gave me a very old-fashioned look, as if to say, you know, of course she should have had a gun carriage. I think the Queen had never been a big friend of Mrs. Thatcher, but had a proper understanding of her importance. And Mrs. Thatcher, of course, was absolutely correct monarchist, and I found it maddening talking to her that she would never tell me anything about the Queen, not one damn thing. She really believed in that propriety about the exchange between sovereign and prime minister, which most of her successors have ignored.
And it's striking talking about Churchill, though I think no prime minister since Churchill has had such a prominent afterlife. Just looking at the films where Margaret Thatcher has been played by everyone from Patricia Hodge to Lindsay Duncan to Meryl Streep to Gillian Anderson to Leslie Andown, and most recently to Harriet Walter in Brian Maggie, about her relationship with Brian Walden, it seems to me that she remains as prominent as ever, and also as we approach her centenary, there's been a softening of attitude towards her. You'll remember in 2002 when her statue was decapitated in Guildhall, which I thought was actually a sign of how incredibly prominent she still was. But would you say that a century on, even her foes have developed a sort of respect for her?
Yes, and I would. And the key person in that, by the way, this respect's always been there in the rest of the world. It's only in Britain that there's been a sort of problem about it, funnily enough. I mean, maybe for the Republic of Ireland, but not much. Maybe Argentina, but I don't know. And so she's huge respect in the United States, Eastern Europe, Far East, etc., Arab world, Israel. But I think what people often say to me in interviews about her, well, she was very divisive, wasn't she? And while I wouldn't deny that, I think the first thing to understand about her, if you try to look at it neutrally, the first thing to understand about her as a politician was she was extremely successful. And what I mean by that is that she did what she wanted to do and got electoral reaffirmation for it three times. Every time she tried, she got it. And that makes her unique. Blair came quite close, but not so close. And no one else anywhere close in modern British political history. So people, as time passes, they respect that, and they respect the fact that she was seriously concerned to achieve things. And that's what's so frustrating about current politics, is that sort of so few things actually get achieved. And for better or worse, and of course it's actually the truth, it's for better and worse, Mrs. Thatcher did an absolute mass of things. And I think actually it was your father, Ferdy, who described how this worked, which was, he said, the whole time she was in Whitehall, there was a sense in government, there was a sense all across Whitehall of her angry will, what he called her angry will. So you knew what she wanted, and you sort of knew you had to try and provide it. And unlike Trump's angry will, which is certainly there, it was much more directed. It was much more consistent. You know, you knew what she'd think about something before she'd said it, usually, if you were close to it. And this was incredibly powerful. And this mattered, therefore, both at home and in the world, and as a sort of model of a certain way of governing and a certain type of leadership personality. And that, I don't think, will go away. So I think people will continue to be very interested in that in hundreds of years. And so in the whole of British history, you know, this would perhaps apply to the younger Gladstone, possibly Lloyd George, Churchill and Thatcher. That's about it. That's pretty big, actually.
Well, that's a very good place to end a very enjoyable appearance by Charles Moore on Radio Oldie. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Harry.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.